This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
If you Google the words Bob Dylan and Guitar Hero, you will learn that his music was added to the Activision game in 2009. If you try to search for Bob Dylan and guitar style, you'll find a bunch of articles about his guitars. For a guy who gets talked about a lot, not many people seem to be talking about his musicianship in general or his guitar playing in specific. But there is a rebellious musicologist in Oslo, Norway, who's been working diligently to right this wrong. His name is Alf Ostrom, and for years he's run a great website called Dylan Chords, which shares guitar tab and more serious musical analysis about Bob Dylan, the musician. He's recently started publishing on Substack and a page called Dylanology, where he recently started a series exploring Bob's guitar work specifically on Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong. Perfect timing for our own look at these two albums, and so we got together for a chat a few weeks ago. Alf has a PhD in musicology and a deep passion for Dylan's work. As you'll hear today, he has the ability to both hear and then verbalize what Dylan is doing musically, helping those of us who don't understand suspended chords and harmonics to appreciate and start to understand what Bob is doing and why it excites us. We talked about Bob's guitar playing, how it evolved from his early solo acoustic period through the decades, how it changed on these two albums specifically, and what happened to it from Time Out of Mind forward. We also talked about how Bob plays in concert. More importantly, Alf starts to point out and explain some of what Bob is doing that I think most of us don't see or understand and could certainly not name. And like the great Dylan authors who unpack some of what's going on in Bob's lyrics, I think it's fascinating and instructive. We spoke for about an hour and made it through only a few of the points he talks about in those recent Substack articles. I recommend you go read them via the links in our show notes. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Alf as much as I did, and I hope it inspires you to shift a little more focus during your listening to Bob's guitar and what's going on in the music in general. Please let me know in the comments if you like this kind of beginner's deep dive into the musical side of Dylan. I'd like to do more of them if it's well received. Well, welcome, Alf. Thanks for agreeing to talk about World Gone Wrong and Bob Dylan's music and the great work you do on your Dylanology Substack.
Well, thanks for having me.
We talked about just coincidence. We've been focusing on Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong, and you just dug into it in a couple of great posts on Substack. And what's interesting to me is, as we chatted about an email, that the musical side of Dylan doesn't get as much attention and discussion and especially dissection as the lyrics do. And I don't think that's because the music at all doesn't impact or register with people. I think they lack, I'm speaking for myself here, they lack the ability to describe it or discuss it in a way that they can about lyrics, whether they're qualified or not, maybe on that ground. But lyrics are, the music is just kind of this mystery to most of us. But you clearly have the ability to get inside it and break it down and explain it, which is great. And so we're going to talk a little bit today about how you do that. Maybe just introduce yourself a little bit and how you came to have that skill and how you started bringing it to what Bob Dylan does.
Well, okay, I'm a guy from the west coast of Norway, which means that there was nothing like a record store anywhere. So I spent some time looking for the first Dylan album to buy when I was around 15 or 16, and I ended up buying Highway 61, which turned out to be a happy choice. But I've been working my way through, how should I put it, the all kinds of musical worlds, and insisting on, I knew that Beatles were the Beatles were great. Bob Dylan was good. Beethoven was great, and Bach was good. And there was this French book called Do You Like Brahms? So I knew that Brahms was important to, it was important to have an answer to that. So I spent most of my time actually listening to music of all kinds. And eventually I took a PhD in musicology on Gregorian chant, which is quite some distance from Bob Dylan, but maybe not really, because this is actually a segue to Good As I've Been to You, because that was one of the first albums that I bought after I had been saved, so to speak. And I stood in the record store and listened to the first guitar stuff on Frankie and Johnny, and I was just I was sold. And then when Well Gone Wrong came out the year after, I heard that those first really ugly sounds on the title track, and I just thought I have to have that, and I have to understand why it is. And now I come back to what you were saying initially, that most people may be attracted to his lyrics and on some level connect to his music, but they think that you have to have some kind of special understanding to be able to explain that. And I my point of departure has always been, okay, I understand that there's something great here because I'm touched. I may not dance because I'm not that kind of academic, but anyway, I'm touched by it. Ergo, there must be something here that explains that. And since this is all just sound waves, there must be some way to just pick those sound waves apart and say, okay, maybe it's that tone, or maybe it's that little pause in the voice, or that slight inflection, or that tinge of sadness, or whatever it is that makes me want to connect with that. And Good As I've Been to You and Well Gone Wrong are, I think, prime examples of that, because it is so simple, so bare, and so seemingly, what's the word, rudimentary, and yet it has this ability to touch me and you, obviously, evidently, and the rest of us. I then took it upon me to try to put some of that into words. And that's the second aspect of it. I mean, I am a musicologist, and there are not many musicologists who are interested in Bob Dylan's music, because it is seemingly too simple. And I mean, the cliche, he can't sing, he can only play three chords on his guitar. What's in it for me as a musicologist to invest time and energy and reputation on investigating something that is so simple?
What I started thinking when you were describing that is, you know, in terms of the simplicity of his, or the rudimentary nature of what he does, is just like the lyrics get credit for driving his success often, but in the same way that not the singing voice, but the expressiveness and the method he uses to sing, which, you know, some like Paul Williams and other people have done a great job of breaking down the stretches and syllables and all of that. The music is clearly part of the alchemy. I also like the idea of looking at these albums in particular as a great place to start, because if it's complicated for me anyway to try to understand what's going on in a single guitar, it really becomes impossible when there's five people, or who knows what's in the mix, you know, 17 things somewhere that the engineer has mixed in there, which are changing and echoing on themselves. And, you know, I hear people talk about that stuff, and I'm glad they can tell or describe it. But, you know, I just wind up with the resultant feeling and impact. It is clever and useful for us to say, boy, let's start with something that those of us who don't, aren't PhDs in musicology, can break apart and start to understand. Because I think the same way when we listen to, you know, a Michael Gray or one of the other great analysts of the lyrics, we might not be able to do it for the next lyric ourselves, what they have done. but we now understand it, and it opens up something about that we take to the rest of the listening, which is kind of the point. Let's just start. We'll dig in a little bit to your article. I love the beginning. In case you hadn't noticed, Dylan is strange.
Mm-hmm.
But you're referring, you know, to the way he talks about guitar. And then, you know, in the intro to this, you talk about the fact, and I think this is an important insight for those of us who can't process music in this way, that something was different about this, the sound on these acoustic albums. I've now read all the reviews, contemporaneous reviews, and subsequent reviews of Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong. And maybe it's a different discussion, but it also must be frustrating for a musicologist or someone with your way of looking at this to read reviews that never touch these issues at all. You know, like, how can you review an album and not be able to articulate or even reference that he's doing something significantly different on the guitar, and that's the feeling, you know, that comes through? And, you know, you say, to summarize, there it was, a magnificent, skilled, exciting guitar track, which is not a phrase that probably has been written a whole lot of times about Dylan guitar track.
No. Well, the one exception being Don't Think Twice, which Clinton Hale insists is not played by Dylan at all. But that aside, it came as a surprise for good reason, because he hadn't been playing the acoustic guitar alone. One or two exceptions during the early parts of the Neverending Tour, and also some tracks on the Rolling Thunder review. But Dylan with a guitar all by himself, doing something exciting, was of course a huge novelty, and it took me by surprise, and probably everyone else too. And you said that I would be frustrated by the lack of reference to that in the reviews. I take that as a reflection of knowledge that those reviewers have, but are maybe not aware of, so that when people are thrilled by these albums, it's of course by the lyrics and by the phrasing and so on, but it is also primarily by the music making. I mean, if Dylan had come to New York in 1962 and went out on the street corners in the village and recited his poetry, nobody would have paid him any mind. So from the very beginning, it was because of his way of merging musical sound and linguistic sound that has made that impact. And I hear that so strongly on these two albums as well. The what I referred to in the second piece as the mess in the message, those little extras that make us recognize this not just as a song, as a stylized expression in with discrete pitches and fixed rhythms, but as an extension of someone, as if someone were just speaking freely and saying something very important to us about little Maggie or about Delia or death or love or all those things. As if it came straight out of his own mind through his guitar. And it's those aspects of the guitar playing, those little frowns and winks and inflections in tone that I think creates this impression of someone just speaking freely.
And I love the way that you describe those, and you have little clips in your posts where people can see or can hear what you're relating to. So when you recognize either at the time or later the distinction in his guitar playing in this early 90s from earlier, I guess it makes me want to think, ask directly about the comparison to the Dylan album, the first one, where we have him and a guitar, and is it evidence of greater competency, or is it taking a different approach? When you boil down to what was different 30 years later from the earlier. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of other recordings of him alone with an acoustic guitar in those early couple of years. Was it growth? Was it a conscious change? Was it he needed a different tool to accomplish a different goal that made this 90s playing so different?
I think it was all of those. I think that he, this will be speculation, but I assume that when he's sitting by himself at home with a guitar over his knee, he will have been played all kinds of styles, even in the during the 80s and the 70s and all the periods where we don't have any evidence of it. But that aside, I think that the late 80s would have been a period of change for him, and that is one of the points that I've been trying to approach from different angles. For instance, I wrote this about Dark Eyes, which has some of the same kind of playing as on these two 90s acoustic albums, in that he is working with these sometimes strange, sometimes or at least unusual shapes, chord shapes for him, up and down the neck. I mean, the guitar playing on Dark Eyes is just weird. Why would he do that? Why would he play it like that? Why would he play it in A and not just in G, which would make for a much easier guitar track? And given the recording history of Dark Eyes, I mean, at least the way he tells it, that he needed an acoustic track, and he just went back to the hotel room and wrote it and recorded it the next day in one take or whatever. That, to me, tells me that this is what Dylan can play in his sleep. Dark Eyes, the playing on Dark Eyes is not strange, it's not an arrangement, it's just what he does. And the same shapes, the same chord shapes, we find also in, for instance, the little instrumental interludes and intros in Lone Pilgrim, for instance, the same kinds of strange shapes. And there are three of those small snippets in Lone Pilgrim, and they sound like it is the same thing he's playing, but it's not. I mean, they both start on a C chord and end on a C chord, but other than that, it's nothing is the same. There are different length, different chords, different combinations, different ways of going into and out of those starting and end points. And it all sounds like one simple melody, which is seemingly is the same, but it's not. And I don't for a second believe that he has been rehearsing those interludes and planning them and arranging them. This is just what comes out. And that, I think, is one important aspect of that style, that it is so internalized that this is just what comes out.
There's an interesting analogy here, which is that when I talked to Michael Gray about the songs on this album a week or two ago, and he mentioned that in Diamond Joe, Dylan says the word Joe four different ways in four different verses. Mm. And again, from Michael's perspective, no one else would say Joe four ways, just as you have the insight to, you know, analyze and say he played this chord or this sequence four different ways.
And well, when we're on that point, I mean, Delia is even worse. It's 11 verses and four or five instrumental interludes. And the length of that central chord where he either recites or sings his little middle phrase or in the instrumental interludes, just nothing. It ranges from 10 to 20 beats. No two versions are the same length. Sometimes he comes in on the beat, other times off the beat. And it's just a mess. And the ability to land on his both two feet every verse, and it's all this different, and this feeling that was that remains is, all the friends I ever had are gone. There's no meaning in this. There's no sense left in this world. And he does that by exactly saying Joe four different times, or in this case, I haven't got any friends. In 11 different ways plus five instrumental ways. So that to me is a standout track in that respect.
So let's jump back for a second to the 60s, because I want to then use that for the distinction you make about the 90s. So you say there had been two decades of unsophisticated strumming, and then suddenly there was varied and skilled guitar playing again. And I think for people, you know, who aren't so studied in this, you do a very nice thing and break down what you say was the early style: a steady pendulum movement of the right hand, a strong emphasis on the bass string as the main accent, and light in between strumming on higher strings on unaccented beats, frequently with some regular rhythm pattern. And, you know, the details people can read, and you point at She's No Good, Talking New York Blues, Man of Constant Sorrow, House of the Rising Blues, or even Blowing the Wind as examples of this. So, and I think people, right, we know the old kind of simple. I mean, yeah, you know, we're not able to judge. But you actually end kind of with a compliment. So Dylan's able to provide a guitar track that can stand in for a full band. He's got a bass line, upper string substitute for harmony, and it even somehow fulfills the duties of a drummer. For this reason, his 60s playing style is a model for anyone who wants to play guitar. So the point here isn't bad to good. It's one thing he was doing before that was obviously effective, both for him and pleasing to us, and something new, which is thrilling in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, in the 60s, he had to be the full band. I mean, he didn't have a band, so he had to come up with a playing style that was both interesting and simple enough to be able to do it while singing and playing harmonica and entertaining the audience and doing all the pacing and everything. So, yes, I consider the playing style before he went electric as a model to follow, and it's probably no coincidence that millions of aspiring guitar heroes have followed him in that sense. Sadly, also in playing harmonica in a bad way, but that's that's another issue. But I mean, for instance, when he talks about his playing on freewheeling, when he refers back to that, he is obviously very proud of his guitar work. He says that I was able to do quite a lot of different things. I did his finger picking. I did some of this and some of that. So he was obviously proud of his work, and it also shows throughout the early 60s that he was not, he may have presented himself or wanted to present himself as this scruffy little thing who just arrived on the train from Oklahoma, but he was, I mean, he always played the best guitars. He had Gibsons and Martins from the very beginning, and he was very conscious about his playing style, and that is what shows. I mean, the Gaslight Tape, for instance, which is wonderful in the way that the finger picking and all these little small licks or riffs that he does in, like, for instance, Barbara Allen. He was a very accomplished, not a virtuosic, but a very accomplished guitar player from the beginning. Then, of course, he had a band, and he never had any, well, whether opportunity or obligation or necessity to prove that. I think that the story that he tells in Chronicles about his hand injury in the 80s, and also this strange Lonnie Johnson thing, the mathematical music stuff, I've written quite a lot about that as well, trying to explain that as a way of approaching playing guitar or soloing on stage, picking some tones, picking some patterns, and just sticking to them. I think that is the core of the Neverending tour, the two note solos or the Pink Blanc stuff that he's been doing and ridiculed for. And I think, and to come back to those, the acoustic albums again, that is what he was developing from the late 80s through those, by many, ridiculed years of the early 90s. I mean, at the time, people didn't really like his playing in 1991, just prior to these albums. There was this Stuttgart concert, the worst concert in his career. He was probably completely drunk as well, but even so. I think I hear a development, a conscious development, just of the same kind as he was insisting in the early 60s that, no, I want to get this right. And like his girlfriend Bonnie Beecher talks about, she wanted to invite her friends over to listen to Bob, because she knew he could play some really great stuff, but he wanted to play the harmonica because he had got his harmonica and it sounded terrible, but he wanted to get it right. And he did eventually. And the same thing with the guitar playing in the early years of Never Ending Tour. It's not good, it's not great, but it's getting there. And he does it on stage so we can all see it. And I think there's a direct line from that comment about the Lonnie Johnson method, the mathematical music, to these albums from the early 90s.
Wow. Well, that all of that's really fascinating, because so much of that, I don't want to say it's glossed over, but it's kind of it's either misinterpreted or glossed over, or there's something there, right? What you're doing is finding a continuum in things where people just sort of go, oh, that's, you know, he wasn't good at that then, or that, or he was drunk and those shows aren't, you know, aren't great. But it's very interesting for us to now see how one thing turns into another. And the thing that mostly I wanted to ask you, and I, at some risk of deviating here, is what you see, right? This period is seen as the launch for what we got in Time Out of Mind later. Mm. Now that is not usually talked about in terms of the music, because the Lenoir stuff is so in a so different world, but do you see, you know, he came back to ground to the folk songs he wasn't writing. He was getting himself, you know, back together. Is there something musically you see that, out of what you just stretched back into the 80s, into the early 90s, that you can draw the line to what happened in the late 90s and even the, you know, the whole string of albums, the Love and Theft and so forth? Or did he leave this behind and land somewhere else?
I don't know. I think, I don't know what to answer to that, because I think, he did leave that behind. I mean, that's one of the fascinating things about these two albums, that there is virtually not any sign of any of that in any of the live shows. I mean, he does many of the songs live, of course, in 1992, 1993, and so forth. But the playing style it's gone, basically.
That's interesting. I'm in the middle of putting together, you know, a new compilation of the live versions of these songs. Mm. And so you're saying that the intricacy and the delicacy or the techniques we find on the album are rarely in the live performances. About half of them are performed live, maybe less.
Yeah. Well, some of it is there. And to take this line from the mathematical music and dark eyes further, I mean, one of the techniques that he's using on these albums is to play these riffs high up on the neck of the guitar, like in Delia, that riff, which is played high up with strange chord constellations, and in the Love Henry, for instance, these descending lines based on these standard chord shapes just moved up and down the neck. That is exactly the soloing style that he's been using throughout the Never Ending Tour, at least, and started playing the piano instead. So that aspect of it, I think, is definitely there. What is special about Judas I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong is, of course, that he has to do the whole thing himself, just like in the early 60s. Whereas when he does these songs live, he can restrict himself to the fun bits, all the doodling up and down the neck. And I think that he developed some kind of expertise in fiddling around with strange or insistently strange guitar figures anywhere on the neck. One of the things I'm working on and have been working on for quite some time is the solos in Mr. Tambourine Man during the late spring and summer tour of 1993, where I've been transcribing all his solos after the third or fourth verse of Mr. Tambourine Man from those summer shows in 93. And it's amazing how he works out these ideas from, you can trace it from concert to concert. And so in the Cascais in Portugal in the summer, he really hits the soft spot where everything falls into place. But I found the first, where there's this one little motif that he doodles around with. But I found it first time in, I think, 16th of April in one of the US shows, where this little traumatic thing that he does shows up for the first time. And so that's also one interesting aspect of this thing that he does with the Never Ending Tour, which I hinted at, that this is a constant trying out things on stage before the eyes of all of us, eyes and ears, and he does it without any hint of shame, where other musicians would just, no, we have to go back and rehearse this. Whereas he says, no, let's go and rehearse this some more tomorrow on stage in Stuttgart or in Oslo. And that, to me, is the most, that's mainly what I love about Dylan, that he's so sharing with his rehearsal time.
Well, let's dive into the techniques. So you've identified a series of techniques or elements that you found throughout these albums that you break down in great detail in the blog post. And the first is the melodic bass, which you talk about Black Jack Davy as the initial example. Let me play the little clip you did. Great first example, and back to our idea that this is, even for me, you can see it's a relatively simple thing. There's not a lot going on. Sounds lovely. It's distinctive. Tell us what you hear in there and what you're pointing out to us that Dylan is doing there.
Well, first of all, he is replicating the melody of the song on the bass strings, the lowest part of the he plays the melody on the bass strings, basically. That's what he does. While doing so, he keeps some of those elements from the early 60s style that you refer to, that the ping pong between the bass strings and the upper strings, where the upper strings are playing the part of the rhythm section. What he does here, in addition to all that, is that the song is in minor, but he plays it in a way that it plays it in with G major chords, but in G minor, which means that there has to become clashes between the open second string, which is a B, and the third of the melody, which is the B flat. So you all constantly have this clash between the B flat on the second deepest string, second lowest string, and the B on the second brightest string, and that is one of the messy things that he does on this track. He doesn't care if two tones that really don't belong together, they are as jarring as any two tones can be together. He doesn't care. He just plays them completely aware that the playing style is it's not polished. It's rough, and it lacks this regard for beauty that, I mean, you might see this as his protest against the atrocious 80s mixes on the Empire Burlesque and even those albums that I won't even knock out loaded and stuff like that. I mean, this is as far from Empire Burlesque as you can possibly get, because he just emphatically doesn't care if it sounds like shit, and that, because that's what he wants.
But it's interesting because, well, simplistically, it sounds great, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, I wonder whether, as you started describing that, my first thought is, well, it sounds like these technically don't go together, or this methodology is unusual in some way, and yet it works. So is one way to look at it to say, well, I don't care what the ingredients are if the final culmination sounds and feels the way I want. This is kind of a perfect way to break this down, because he's, according to you, you know, he's violating these technical things. There's these clashes going on. I would never know that. Well, let's do it this way. When a trained musician, you're a musicologist and you're looking at it through a hell of a microscope, if you casually listened, do you think most knowledgeable music people hear that and kind of, is it a wince? Is it a curiosity? Is it a damn, that's inventive? Break down those problems and those strangeness a little bit more, because I think it's, you know, it's interesting. And is it reasonable to say he thinks putting these together produces an overall effect that I actually like and intend, so I'm going to do it?
Well, to take the last things first, I think definitely he wants it like this. I mean, he wants the rawness, and he wants the, I mean, even from on this liner note to John Baez in Concert, volume, is it 2 or 3, which he wrote about the ugliness of he's sitting there by the railroad tracks and ripping out the grass from the ground, and only ugliness is beautiful. I mean, from the very beginning, he has cherished ugliness as a way of expression, rawness, and as opposed to the polished voice of John Baez before he realized that there was some sorrow and some pain in there somewhere, and then he opened up to beauty as a way of as a true way of expressing oneself. But still, he has always loved ugliness. So that's one first part of the answer. A second aspect of it is what Nassim Taleb, the Lebanese philosopher or whatever it is, refers to as when he talks about it, when you talk to someone on the phone, where there is this slight distortion, that actually enhances the understanding or the concentration, because there is this slight amount of dirt or distraction, disturbance, which forces you to focus even more on what is being said. And I think that is exactly what Dylan is doing by introducing these, or by constantly keeping these elements of dirt or grit in his music making. And of course, as a third thing is this protest that I mentioned against the perfect polishedness of the 80s albums and that aesthetic that represents. You asked if musically skilled people will hear the imperfections in the playing, and I will say yes, they hear it, and I will be as bold as to say that you hear it as well. You may not be able to put it into words what it is that you're hearing, but I'm convinced that part of the reason why you like that sound is because there is that dirt in it.
Let me go to the next thing you say about this piece, you know, we just talked about, which is complimentary. All in all, the outcome is fluid and natural sounding accompaniment with a strong sense of melody and filled with harmonic and rhythmic elements in a way that we recognize from the default quote unquote style, you know, outlined above. So obviously you're not being critical about this. You're trying to understand it, why it works, how it's different, and so forth. And I think that's the part that you can help all of us with, to get a little bit of sense of why. Yep. Another quote Michael Gray said the other day that really stuck with me is he talked about the way Dylan says Botany Bay.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he said, you don't have to notice how lovely the way he says it is. But once you do notice, you really should appreciate it. And now you kind of have a new tool to look for in the future. And that's kind of what I sense in this and what I'm, you know, to be honest, hoping for in this, because those of us who care about this, understanding it and just appreciating it, right? With no intent, need, or desire to be able to do anything with it, but to be able to notice, you know, what you're doing on the music is providing examples of what we should notice. Right. We've listened hundreds of times. So let's talk a little bit about, you talk about Dylan in duet and the suspended chords, and maybe they're all suspended fourths. So just introduce us to that technique and this, you know, how this is new and what it does on this album.
Well, the bass melody style is just playing the melody on the bass strings. So that's playing exactly the same thing as he's singing. The second style that I'm pointing out is what I call the Caesar's four thing, for lack of a better word, is what he does there is picking out part singing, so to speak, in his guitar. And when I say this, I mean, this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek that Dylan can't sing in duet, but there is something to it. I mean, I think those duets with Van Morrison are atrocious. I think the duetting with Patti Smith in 1995 on Dark Eyes, precisely, which is one of my favorite songs. But I think the duetting is terrible. I mean, it's very emotional and it's great to have those have him sing those that song, but it really doesn't sound good. And I think that's in both cases, it's because, either Dylan isn't in control, or it's his own song. So, I mean, I think he is incapable of singing his own songs, sticking to one melody there. Whereas when he sings other people's songs, and that's one of the things that he mentions in the producer or engineer mentions in his interview with you or with someone else, Dylan treated those songs that were made by other people with great respect. So he wanted to get them right. He needed to get them right. And I think that's part of the key to why that part singing with the guitar works so well here, because he is true to the melody. He sings the same. He sings the melodies more or less the same way every time. And that means that the intermediary voices that he picks out on the guitar, they work together with the melody that he sings. Whereas when he does his own, for instance, on Desire, the famous Emmylou Harris duets, which she was very dissatisfied with, even though they are great, that's partly because she could never guess where Dylan was going on this verse, rather than the previous verse or where he will go next time. So the unpredictability of Dylan as a singer of his own songs stands in some kind of contrast with his faithfulness to the original when he does other people's songs, and so that's the prerequisite for the kind of playing that he does on those songs that I put in this Caesar's four category, where the melody is move in parallel with the singing, the song singing melody.
Okay, so let's look at Lone Pilgrim is one example that you call out, and I can play some clips. What you say above this is that Dylan uses the C suspended fourth chord to precisely create the kind of counter melody he's incapable of as a singer.
Yeah.
And so where in that, because this is an example of where I read that, I listen to that. Now tell me where in what I hear I'm hearing that.
Well, you hear exactly those tones that he emphasizes in the guitar playing are those tones that make for this kind of Everly Brothers or Leuven Brothers kind of accompaniment or part singing, which moves in thirds or sixths. And not to become too music theoretical, but a third is what makes a chord or a melody major or minor, so that's quite an important interval. And I mean, all country part singing, be it Dolly Parton or Leuven Brothers, move in parallel thirds or sixth, and those, I mean, that
it's the space between the tonal movements
exactly
being
exactly,
consistent
yeah.
that's effective or unique or applies this technique.
Yeah. And whereas he in the bass melody songs, he just plays the melody in on the guitar. Here he plays the second part, the accompaniment, as a perfect kind of country or Everly Brothers kind of accompaniment. So he is actually playing a duet with himself by picking out exactly those tones on the guitar.
Immediately following you, maybe part of the same thought, you say not all the chords are C suspended fourth, of course. In this respect, Lone Pilgrim is an example of fourths, of the fourth use of the C suspended fourth chord as a stand-in for F. The first and third lines of each verse are identical, but here's how Dylan plays them. So you've built a clip there. Obviously, it's not one sustained thing. Break that down for me again. And below that, for people who go read the article, you show the chords to show how they change each time he does it. But is that what we're hearing? We're hearing that it's I don't know if I can even translate this out loud. Instead of C to F to C, it's C to C suspended fourth to C to F to G to C to. So it's a different path through the same forest each time.
So even though he plays the same thing, is it eight times or so? He plays, for instance, that first chord can be a C. It can be a C suspended fourth. It can be in the same position. There can be a C. There can be a C suspended fourth. There can be an F. Or there can be this more emphatic G, F, or F, G, sorry. So the same position in the musical progression can be realized in at least four different ways. And this, what is special about the C-suspended fourth is that it can occupy several different, it can fulfill several different functions, but by being not one specific chord, but something in between, it allows Dylan to slide between those functions and position himself in different ways, emphasizing different moods maybe, or just giving it more of a flesh and bones appearance rather than just the metronomic or the strict chords that a full band would have played there, for instance. So he creates variation, and thus creates an interesting musical texture by constantly moving between those shades or nuances of chord.
So musically, is it challenging or impressive to do the same thing that many ways, and yet many listeners, I don't want to say don't notice, but you know, because maybe it's the variation that we like about it. Is that a hard thing to do to find those changes, or is it just a bold choice?
I think it's neither. I mean, it's not difficult to play it like that, and it's not a bold choice. I think, again, that's just what he does. I mean, he hasn't planned that, oh, in this verse I will play it FG, and this verse I will play it as C suspended fourth. It just happens that way. And I think that's, I mean, when I describe this as Dylan speaking guitar, that's exactly what it does. I mean, it's just what intuitively comes out of his fingers because the lyrics have this or that mode, or because it requires that. For instance, in the last two verses, it begins with FG, FG, and then on the second round, the FG comes in the second position. It's hard to describe it, but there is a huge difference between just slightly adding a little finger on the C chord and making it a C suspended four, and almost no perceptible difference from the C. I mean, it's almost flat to this great do. It's much more energetic. If that's because the lyrics require it, or because this is now we've sung four verses, we need some change. I don't know. I don't know what he was feeling or why he was doing it that. But I'm convinced that he has not planned to play it like this. It just came out that way. And that's what is so, again, so fascinating with Dylan as a musician, that there is this intuitiveness and there is this direct connection with the lyrics, from the lyrics to the guitar, or vice versa.
There's a couple of things in there that are kind of interesting or a little revelatory, which is what I would think, not playing, if it's another chorus in the same thing, being a whatever's below an amateur, that you're supposed to play it the same. So that's why I suggested perhaps it was bold to not do it. But you're saying that the goal, and certainly in Dylan's mind, isn't this is how it goes. It's this is what I'm trying to say. And exactly. If this is what I'm trying to say, it's obvious I wouldn't do it that other way because that's different. That's one thing I like about that. The other is you're describing him musically doing something, the way he changes lyrics, right? He screws around with his lyrics often, mm-hmm. obviously, and are causing great attention and analysis on everyone's part, usually, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about rewrites. I'm talking about just subtle changes that other people just don't do, right? They wrote it this way and they sing it exactly this way. And it's been described as a lack of care. It's been described as lots of things. I always think of it as Bob has an idea he wants to get across. And if I have something I want to tell you, I might choose 3 days in a row to choose different words, but I'm still telling you that thing, and that's all I cared about. And what you're kind of saying is musically, he's saying, I want to say this, and I can think of five ways to say this, and I'm every time I go through it, I might pick a different way, but I'm still saying this, expressing this musical thing. There was never a right, because the right was expressing this. And at least for me, that's not approach to how the musical choices were made I would have ever thought about before.
Mm. No, exactly. I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the rightness not playing any part here at all. It is. Well, whether I don't know if it's communication, but at least it's expression. And what is so special about Dylan, to back that again, is the way he. I mean, when we are talking now, we are so skilled at noticing the slightest hesitations or what I've been referring to. I mean, every little detail we can pinpoint exactly where this person comes from just by the way you are saying certain vowels or so on, and we can read what kind of mood you're in, if you're excited or if you're just bored by it. This musicologist talk lots of nonsense about guitar playing or somewhere in between. We do that when we speak all the time, because we are so skilled at it, reading people. And what Dylan does with his music is taking that exact same thing and putting it into the music making. So yes, there is no right. There is just those small, very minute differences in ways of expressing things. So he's putting those small hesitations in the voice and the excited intakes of breath into his guitar playing.
That's a wonderful way of describing it. It's a real service you're doing, taking this passion of yours and skill and helping the rest of us. It's really interesting and I think helpful. So thanks for doing it and for talking to us today about it.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening.